With the latest agriculture news from across the state and the nation, here's Farm City Newsday by AgNet West. Here's your host, Taylor Hillman.
Good Thursday morning, everybody. Welcome to Farm City Newsday. Thanks for joining AgNet West this morning. We may have seen some progress this week with the trade tiff between the U.S. and China. It would appear that some of the Trump administration's tariff threats may be doing what they hoped they would. We'll have that story here in just a few minutes. First, looking ahead at the calendar, the Citrus Research Board will be hosting their post-harvest conference next week in Oxnard on Tuesday and Wednesday. We will hear more from Cooperative Extension's Mary Lou Arpaia about the agenda later on in the show. And there will be a second installment of the 2018 Avocado Grower Seminar Series next week. This one will focus on old and new tools. California Avocado Commission's Tim Spann and Cooperative Extension advisors will discuss what tools still work and what new tools are worth checking out. You can find out more information on the CRB conference at citrusresearch.org and the Avocado Seminar Series at californiaavocadogrowers.com. Now let's get to today's news. China officially filed a dispute against the U.S. with the World Trade Organization in regards to the U.S.'s new metal tariffs. However, in what seems to be progress in the trade spat between the two countries, China also agreed to lessen tariffs on cars. Analysts hope this is the first step to negotiations before any new tariff threats take effect. Those tariffs will, of course, have major impacts on fruit, nut, wine, and pork industries, as China is a major market for some, especially here in California. Alex Ott of the California Apple Commission says it'll probably also affect crops that don't ship a lot to China.
Well, in terms of the tariffs that are going on in China right now, the California apples industry does not currently ship to China. However, what we're concerned about is the indirect impact the tariffs are going to have on the California apple growers. For example, the apples going to Washington State and to China, once the tariff is in full effect, more than likely those exports to China will drastically be reduced and those apples will have to go somewhere. And the concern is that those apples could potentially put pressures on a domestic market, thus lowering prices and slowing a lot of the movement of not just California apples, but U.S. apples in general.
California apples have a small period of time where they dominate the market. Disrupting that could have major complications for producers.
Correct. Yeah. Think of it as a balloon that if you push on the left side of a balloon and the bubble starts to go, it has that impact. And unfortunately, that's our marketing window. If Chile is late, it shortens that window in the front. If Washington State is early, it shortens the tail end of the window for us. So we're kind of stuck right in between that niche window. And so any pressures that we get will make that bubble either left or right and definitely squeeze the industry. So we like our niche window. We like where we're positioned as California apple industry. We just want to make sure that outside impacts of events that we can't control don't upset, for pardon the pun, the apple cart.
Specialty crop news brought to you today by the Almond Board of California. You can find them online at almonds.com. The Almond Board of California is helping producers comply with a new Food Safety Modernization Act. ABC's Tim Birmingham says there are a few Produce Safety Alliance grower training courses still available.
Tim Birmingham, Director of Quality Assurance and Industry Services for the Almond Board of California.
Tim, we're talking about the produce safety stuff that's coming out. You guys have some trainings coming up that growers should take advantage of, right?
That's right. We've already hosted three trainings, and we have five additional trainings coming up beginning on April 17th, and these are produce safety trainings, so trainings that are recognized as appropriate by FDA for those individuals who are tasked with putting together their farm food safety plan. So growers have to have one individual from each company who's gone through this program that's going to put together the plan, if they have to comply with produce safety.
When some of the dates first came out, it was kind of maybe loosely regulated as it rolled out, but this is something that's eventually going to be a must. So your suggestion, like it was before, was get on top of this, take advantage of these trainings and make sure you got a plan together.
Absolutely. The Almond Board of California right now is hosting these trainings. We're covering most of the costs associated with the training. So we recommend that folks take advantage of it now before, you know, some of the training money dries up and there will be a direct cost, you know, moving forward. Also, even though there's commercial processing exemptions that are available for the farms right now, those exemptions probably will go away at some point in the future, meaning most farms will have to comply. So you might as well go through the training right now, take what you learn from that, and start to build your food safety plan. So when the compliance period kicks in, you're already, you know, well ahead of the curve.
Also, you mentioned that the Almond Board of California is an authorized trainer. So it sounds like these types of training opportunities might not be around as much as like just a normal workshop, because you have to have that, right?
Yeah, to be able to host these trainings, you have to be known as a lead trainer. So we've gone through, myself and another individual here have gone through that training to become certified as lead trainers. But we're also partnering with, say, Food Alliance, who has trainers and lead trainers that can actually work with us on these workshops. So they're going to be out here with us on the 17th, and actually on the next few that are coming up, they're going to be helping us with the training as well.
You got some coming up next week. Where can growers find out more information, RSVP, and all that info?
Yeah, so they can call Jamie Putoff. Her number is 209-549-8267. Or they can go to the Almond Board website, almonds.com, and they can find information on the growing side as well about the upcoming workshop.
This is Farm City Newsday by Agnet West. We'll be right back.
Hi, I'm Marilyn Kenoshita, Tulare County's Ag Commissioner. You're listening to AgNet West Radio.
Welcome back to AgNet West's Farm City Newsday. More agriculture news for you now.
Grower input is needed to gauge the interest of a potential new tool for vole management in ag production. Wildlife specialist at UC Davis, Roger Baldwin, is one of the lead researchers on the project and talked about their work on vole management.
We've been looking at a repellent called anthraquinone, which is traditionally thought of as being a bird repellent. And when we tested it, it was highly repellent, and it lasted for the entire duration of the project, which was up to about 6 weeks.
Baldwin noted why they're conducting the survey, which is being hosted on the UCANR website.
It's not currently registered for rodent use. And so we want to gauge grower interest in this product to hopefully provide additional incentive for the company to pursue registration for this product and provide further support through some of the registration process to show that this is a really important product to get registered.
Well, in today's livestock news, this week the National Cattlemen's Beef Association submitted official comments to the U.S. Department of Agriculture outlining key principles for the regulation of fake meat products. The comments were filed in response to Food Safety Inspection Service petition number 18-01, encouraging USDA to look beyond modifying standards of identity in order to provide adequate protection for beef producers and consumers. NCBA Director of Government Affairs Danielle Beck discusses the comments they filed.
There are a few different asks in our comments, and the first is requesting that the U.S. Department of Agriculture work with FDA to take appropriate immediate enforcement action against improperly labeled imitation products. So in looking at the petition, one of the reasons why we don't believe that just defining and creating a new standard of identity for beef is enough is because if you look at what's happened with the dairy industry, any product that's regulated under FDA has a whole host of rules that are separate to what happens at USDA. And FDA has turned a blind eye to improperly labeled imitation products for quite some time now. The dairy industry first engaged with FDA on soy milk and almond milk back in the early 2000s, I think their first letter that they sent to FDA was in 2001. 17 years later, those products have yet to change their labels. They are still on the market. So we are asking USDA to engage and intervene on our behalf, because USDA has always been a longstanding champion of agriculture, and we believe that they're in the best position to influence FDA in an appropriate manner. You know, we have no problem with the black bean burger because it says it's a black bean burger. You know, the Boca burger, their product labeling for years now has very clearly signified the fact that it's an alternative alternative that's plant-based. The new products that have started to enter the market, they're really inching closer to that line of being misbranded and to misleading the consumer. You know, it's great that a product can bleed and sizzle like real beef, but at the end of the day, it's not real beef. It's packaged similarly. Perhaps the product labels on that package are quite confusing unless you're looking closely. And so really, we just want imitation products to be labeled in a way that's clearly stating the fact that they're alternatives.
Beck says the second part of their comment states NCBA wants USDA's FSIS to have jurisdiction over this instead of FDA.
If you look at what's happened with dairy products at FDA, that is a perfect example of why we don't want these lab-grown meat products to be under FDA jurisdiction. If they're allowed to be regulated under FDA, they'll be allowed to call themselves clean meat and will have lost the battle. It is imperative that these products, as they're grown in a lab and make their way to the market after, you know, reaching commercial scale, are labeled in a way that is legally and scientifically defensible and is not derogatory to traditional beef products in any way whatsoever.
More information can be found on the NCBA website. That's beefusa.org. I'm Randall Wiseman for AgNet West. AgriView with Everett Greiner is next.
Well, it's been a dozen years or more since the U.S. faced that series of problems that threatened to destroy our honeybee industry. Scientists still have not solved the problem, but they found a lot of things that have helped. One effort is to breed a stronger, healthier bee that can survive elements that started all this problem. I don't get many of the details, but I do get frequent dispatches on progress and what is still being done to end the purge. Now, most of my information comes from California because that's where so many farmers with so many different crops depend on bees to pollinate those crops. You got to remember now that the bees need the crops just as much as the crops need the bees. It's an amazing story and one that isn't likely to end this year. One grower put it this way, if you eat, you should be interested. I guess that says it all. And that's AgriView for today. Everett Greiner, AgNet West.
This is Farm City News Day by AgNet West. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Farm City News Day by AgNet West. I'm Taylor Hillman. In another segment of The Way My Father Sees It, which is an opinion piece written by my father from a consumer perspective, this week he's talking about hats. My father says hats are interesting. Lots of people wear hats, usually men, especially working men, although we see them on plenty of women as well. Whether you call them caps, billed hats, or lids, and prefer the style of the snap-pack, Velcro, fitted, or adjustable, hats are truly an American headwear, especially in the agricultural world. Some folks wear hats as part of their uniform, while others wear them to cover areas more exposed to the elements. They're frequently worn to protect the eyes and face from the glare of the sun and, on occasion, to reflect a person's style. You'll see various logos, emblems, and words on the front of these hats, some more obscure than others, and the colors of the hats challenge the spectrum. Any hat makes a great billboard for advertising or to give a shout-out to a favorite political or social cause. My father says you can tell a lot about a person by the hat they wear, how they wear it, and even the shape of the bill. You'll never catch a farmer wearing their hat backwards unless it's to peer into an irrigation pipe or reach into the engine compartment of their tractor. Rarely will you see a ranch hand with their hat on sideways unless they just got jostled by a steer or sideswiped by a tossed hay bale. And you'll rarely find professional sports logo, marijuana leaf, or Grateful Dead logo on the front of a farmer's cap. Usually you'll see the name of a farm equipment or agricultural company, with the exception of being the frequent college or high school logo, usually reflecting their support of the local school's sports team. Don't look for any especially stylish hat on a farmer, and if you see a flat bill or extremely clean hat, it's simply a new hat, and will be bent, billed, and well-worn shortly, probably with a sweat stain before the end of the day. Farmers and ranchers rarely need to buy their hats, with the exception of the aforementioned Scholastic hats. Most working folks' hats are provided by companies and agribusinesses to advertise their products and services. What better way to fly the company flag than to have it worn by honest, hardworking folks? With all that said, you'll find the stylish hats in the mall, not in the field. My father says flat bills are for hip-hopping, not disking and baling. And if you find a sweat-stained, bent-billed hat on the road with a tractor or an odd name or even a funny-looking deer on the front, you can bet it fell off the head of a hard-working guy or gal, and they'll have to get a new one the next time they're in town. At least that's the way my father sees it.
The many great reasons why growing a garden is good for us. That's coming up on This Land of Ours. For anyone looking for ways to lead healthier lives, it can happen by starting a garden. Producing your own food naturally will lead to clean eating. We are able to grow local, organic vegetables right in our own yard for the same price of some seeds. You'll get physical exercise from the amount of squatting, bending, picking, and pruning. Mood elevation happens when seeing fruits of your labor, especially when starting those plants, whether they're fruits, veggies, or flowers from seedlings. Another thing that will make us feel good is the vitamin D we soak up from the sun while being outdoors. Not only the sunshine, but the fresh air from the many things in bloom. Gardens also give many a sense of relaxation and mental stimulation. They encourage us and ground us, soothe us, and keep us healthy. It can also be a great way to get the whole family involved. I'm Kathy Eisen for AgNet West.
Good day, everybody. Albert J. Hernandez, the Untamed Chef for AgNet West. And welcome to the California Kitchen, where you can learn how to cook in under 3 minutes or less. I'm your host with the most. Let's get started. So it has officially come. Today is demo day here in beautiful Murphy's, California. And we are coming at you live from Marisolio Olive Oil and Balsamic Tasting Room here in beautiful Murphy's, California, coming at you live from my cooking class. And we are going to be demonstrating today over the airwaves how to make a beautiful, one-of-a-kind camarón al mojo de ajo Marisolio style. Let's get started. So the first thing we need to remember is this. We like prawns. We like, you know, we want to make sure that there's a lot of good flavor in this. Now, mojo de ajo is really translated garlic, lime, and olive oil. And it's a sauce that goes on top of anything. Now, camarón is a fancy way of saying prawn or shrimp. Remember, big shrimp are called what? Prawns. So let's always remember that whenever we order prawns, we're expecting a nice, good prawn. Usually about a good 16 to 20 is where prawns start being considered prawns. Anything smaller than that is going to be a shrimp. So when I make this dish here, what I'm going to do, now remember, I only have 4 people in my family. So I'm going to take 12 beautiful prawns, and we're going to go ahead and make sure we remove the tails, and we're also going to make sure we remove all the shells. And a lot of people are like, well, the tail brings a little bit of ambiance and flavor. That may be true, but you have to also remember that whenever you are cooking, the least amount of things you have to remove once you're done and able to eat makes it so much more desirable and accessible for people and for yourself to truly appreciate and enjoy your dish. So what I'm going to do first is we're going to take our prawns. We're going to make sure they're nice and they're clean. This is super important. Once my prawns are clean, I want to give them a nice little rinse. We always rinse our prawns because we can never clean our prawns enough. And trust me when I say that. You don't want to bite into some shrimp poop. And trust me, that's exactly what most people don't do and end up biting into. So we don't want to bite into any shrimp poop at all. So very important, we're going to clean our prawns. I'm going to go ahead and use just a nice Cajun blend. You could buy a Cajun blend over the counter, or you can make your own. I like using just a pre-bought one for this recipe, only because when I give the recipe out, a lot of times people make it way too spicy. We're going to get 2 hot skillets, and all I'm going to put in there is some garlic olive oil, and we're going to put our prawns in there. They're going to cook on each side for about 37 seconds. And then we're going to take them out, drizzle them with a little bit more garlic olive oil here at Marisolio, and also drizzle with some key lime balsamic vinegar, and enjoy. I'm Albert J. Hernandez. You can call me the Untamed Chef for AgNet West.
This is Farm City News Day by AgNet West. We'll have more of the day's agriculture news in just a moment. And remember, you can always get the latest agriculture news from around the state and the nation at our website, agnetwest.com. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Farm City News Day by AgNet West. I'm Taylor Hillman. In today's interview segment, we hear more about the Citrus Research Board's post-harvest conference. AgNet West Brian German talked with Cooperative Extension's Mary Lou Arpaia, who helped put the agenda together for the conference.
Mary Lou Arpaia, Cooperative Extension Specialist for Subtropical Horticulture, University of California.
Now, you are scheduled to be the conference moderator at the upcoming 39th Annual Post-Harvest Pest Control Conference, and it looks like it's a pretty impressive list of speakers. So what are some of the major topics of discussion going to be?
Well, we have a large session this year revolving around food safety. This is mainly because attendants from previous years have asked for food safety. So we have Trevor Soslow and Linda Harris from UC Davis talking about their research on citrus. We have a food safety auditor, Tanya Trejo, also speaking. And then we have a person talking about, from Jim Mattiscavage's research laboratory, talking about sanitizers. We also have quite a few talks on post-harvest quarantine issues, which is always an important thing for citrus, and so much citrus in the state is exported. And so we have Spencer Wolf and David Oberlin from USDA Parlier. We also have Roger Vargas is coming from USDA and Hilo, Hawaii, to talk about his work on fruit flies. And then we're very happy also to have Wilma DePoy. She works for Citrus Research International in South Africa, and she's giving two talks, both revolving around disease, post-harvest disease management of citrus in South Africa.
And with such a wide range of things being discussed at the conference, who would benefit the most from attending?
Well, anybody who works in post-harvest handling of citrus will benefit from this meeting, since they will have an update on trade issues, post-harvest fungicides, which is a very important part of post-harvest handling of citrus, since we have to deal with Penicillium blue and green mold in the post-harvest environment. So anybody who works in post-harvest handling of fruit, but the meeting was originally designed for technical people working in the packing houses. The meeting started 39 years ago. It was developed by Dr. Joe Eckert, who was a post-harvest pathologist at UC Riverside. And then I took the meeting over, I can't even remember, something like 25 years ago.
I also understand there's going to be some continuing education units for the event.
Exactly. That's an important part of the meeting, is to provide people who are working in packing houses actually technical information that helps them get continuing education for what they actually work on, which is a packing house. So we're very happy this year we have 9 hours of continuing education credit, and a half hour of that is laws and reg.
Registration is open for the annual Santa Maria Strawberry Field Day on Wednesday, May 9th at Manzanita Berry Farms in Santa Maria. The first presentation will begin at 8:30 that morning with a regulatory update on pesticides and fumigation from Deputy Ag Commissioner Lottie Martin and IPM Specialist for Santa Barbara County, Mel Graham. Other presentations include a grower's perspective on field production of strawberries, the role of silicon and calcium in pest and disease management, as well as the opportunities and challenges of growing tabletop strawberries. UC Strawberry and Vegetable Crops Advisor for San Luis Obispo and Santa Barbara Counties, Sarinda Dara, will be presenting information on biological and synthetic nutrients and amendments to improve strawberry health and yield. There will also be an update on weed management in strawberry crops from Cooperative Extension Specialist Steve Finnemore. 3 DPR and 4 CCA continuing education credits have been requested for the field day, happening at Manzanita Berry Farms in Santa Maria on May 9th. I'm Brian German for AgNet West Radio Network.
Citrus forecasts are up slightly month to month, but down still across the board from last year. Gary Crawford has more.
This time of year, you would not expect much change in USDA's forecast for the orange crop, and expectations are met in this week's report. The Florida all orange crop forecast, 45 million boxes, same as last month's forecast. But, of course, USDA Florida State statistician Mark Hudson says,
compared to last year, all oranges is down 35%, and 2 years ago, down 45%.
Blame greening and Hurricane Irma for some of that. Meanwhile, the California all orange forecast, also same as last month, 44.5 million boxes. That would be down 8% from last season. And we have a Texas orange crop forecast now. That crop did change quite a bit from the previous forecast. USDA looking at a Texas crop, 2.1 million boxes, up 15% from the last estimate, up 54% from last season. Put it all together, you get a forecast for the U.S. at 3.5 3.9 million tons, just slightly more than last month's estimate, but down 23% from last season. Gary Crawford for the U.S. Department of Agriculture, Washington.
Now recapping our top story. China officially filed a dispute against the U.S. with the World Trade Organization in regards to the U.S.'s new metal tariffs. However, in what seems to be progress in the trade spat between the two countries, China also agreed to lessen tariffs on cars. Analysts hope this is the first step to negotiations before any new tariff threats take effect. Those tariffs will, of course, have major impacts on fruit, nut, wine, and pork industries, as China is a major market for some, especially here in California. Alex Ott of the California Apple Commission says it'll probably also affect crops that don't ship a lot to China.
California apples industry does not currently ship to China. However, what we're concerned about is the indirect impact the tariffs are going to have on the California apple growers. For example, the apples going to Washington State and to China, once the tariff is in full effect, more than likely those exports to China will drastically be reduced and those apples will have to go somewhere.
California apples have a small period of time where they dominate the market. Disrupting that could have major complications for producers.
And so any pressures that we get will make that bubble either left or right.
To get more information on topics you've heard today, visit AgNet West online at agnetwest.com. You can also follow AgNet West on Twitter and Facebook with @AgNetWest. Follow Brian German @BrianAgNetWest and Taylor Hillman @TheManOfTheHill. This has been Farm City Newsday by AgNet West.